thank you for coming. This is the Resources Committee meeting. The date is February 7th. Am I correct? February 7th. And first, I'd like to start with some housekeeping. If you own a cell phone, put them on vibrate. If they ring, I get to keep them. You get to buy them back. And usually the price has got to do with some carbohydrate product or other. We've got a few things to do today. First, I'd like to say present is Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Johnson, Vice Chair Seaton, and Representative Coring, and myself, Co-Chair Gatto. We have before us an overview from the Division of Oil and Gas. Kevin Banks, the Acting Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, will talk to us about this pretty phenomenal document we have in front of us. He will be aided by the ever-capable Marie Crosley. She stepped out for a minute. We'll be joined off-net by Kurt Gibson, the Acting Deputy Director, and in addition, joined later by Julie Houle and Will Nebeski. And with that in mind, I give you the floor. Oh, she just showed up late, but it's a penalty for being late. Forget to say your name twice. But thank you for being here. If you would,
thank you very much.
A couple of complicated maps here. I think they're complicated, and I'm sure you're going to fix it so they're less complicated.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I sure hope I can do that for you. My name is Kevin Banks. I am the Acting Director at the Division of Oil and Gas, and I'm delighted to be able to meet with you today. And I hope that this overview is just the start of a dialogue that the division can have with you and all of your members as the over the course of the next couple of years. I am very pleased to be able to tell you about our division and about oil and gas in Alaska. I wanted to point out to you that the mission statement, which appears on page 2, is truly a reflection of Article 8 of the Constitution, and I take it very seriously, and I've repeated it frequently to the people that work with me at the Division of Oil and Gas to make sure that they all understand that our role is to manage our resources for the maximum benefit of all Alaskans.
Brief interruption for the record. We've been joined by Representative Guttenberg and Representative Edgeman. So thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What we do in the Division of Oil and Gas is basically encourage exploration and development of our lands, of the state lands, for oil and gas resources, and in turn maximize our revenue from oil and gas production.
Last interruption. And we've been joined by Representative Roses, and now we have all 9 members present. Proceed.
Thanks. And lastly, to maximize the benefits of oil and gas development here in Alaska. And I might add that in terms of the way I look at things, and maybe it's because of my commercial background, my background as an economist, is that, and also because it's easier to add dollars than a lot of other kinds of benefits that come to this state, that I view our role as a asset manager, basically, for the board of directors of this enterprise, that maximizing revenues is a very important role and a very important part of what we do. The benefits associated with jobs and the benefits of utilizing our resources in other spin-off industries in the economy are very important. But I think it's fair to say that the first thing that's going to hit my lights is going to be, are we getting what we are entitled to under the provisions of our agreements, our leases, and the relationship that we forge with the industry? And to give you an indication about what kind of assets we're talking about, on page 4 is a list of the 10 largest producers in the state of Alaska. And you'll see here that the state of Alaska turns out to be number 4. And I don't think many people think of us in that regard. And furthermore, we're four times larger than number five, as it turns out. We have an enviable position in terms of the energy market in North America and the kind of production that we turn out. It's something in the order of 100 to 120,000 barrels a day. Most oil companies, I'm sure, would be delighted to have that kind of energy position and position to play in the market.
Is it okay to have questions as we go along?
I think that would be reasonable, sir. Okay. To give you an indication of that, some of you have heard these talks before, I'm sure, but we would like to remind you that petroleum revenues from oil and gas, constitute 90%, up to 90% of our total state general fund revenue. And this last fiscal year 06, the division was responsible for about $1.8 billion of that, of the total. And about $600 million of our revenues went into the permanent fund as the normal course of our royalty collections. Total is about $2.4 billion. Now, that means that it means that the Division of Oil and Gas, in managing its lands, is contributing to better than half, at least last year, and we may hope so this coming year, depending on how the Department of Revenue's successes are measured in its tax collections, for all of the revenues of the state that that we all rely on. Revenue on the state lands, royalty revenues, have been increasing in the last few years.
So you want, why don't you just say page seven, so
yes.
It's easy for us to follow.
Sorry, and then page seven is a story that unfortunately is a sad reminder that in spite of the increases in revenues, we're still looking at a decline in production. I might also make a point of this one table on page seven, the graphic on page seven. Today we are receiving over 60% of our, or selling over 60% of our royalty to Flint Hills. And they represent a substantial part of the revenue stream that we're getting from royalties right now, more than we receive from any of the other producers individually. And I think that's an important point to, a takeaway point to make.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, what percentage of our royalty is taken in kind versus in value?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that would be my point. 60% of our royalty barrels are taken in kind and sold to Flint Hills. Flint Hills is our sole customer for royalty in kind.
Not Kenai. None of it goes Kenai, or?
No longer, sir. We used to sell. I think we stopped selling oil to the Tesoro refinery in Nikiski in 1998.
So I take it Kenai then brings it up on a ship and processes it that way?
I think most of the oil that Tesoro uses comes from the Cook Inlet. They also bring oil in from Valdez. They ship oil from Valdez. They also have refineries in the lower 48. So they're working their tankers to supply their own refineries as well.
Thank you. So, Representative Seaton, follow-up?
Yeah, a follow-up on that. So do we receive the same or pretty much equivalent value out of the oil that we take in kind versus what we take in value? I mean, how do the dollars per barrel of oil balance between what we take in kind versus what we take in value?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we receive more for the sales of royalty in kind, and that we are actually obliged to. Our own regulations require it. When making the choice to sell oil in kind, we have to meet that goal. The contract was drafted in such a way that we could at least guarantee at the time that the deal was done in 2004 that we would get at least 30 cents more. As a consequence of the formula that we use to calculate royalty in kind, we're actually receiving much more than that, that as compared to what we receive for royalty and value.
Flint Hills, don't they have a lawsuit currently pending to recover some of that money?
Mr. Chairman, there are there's a dispute, two disputes basically, before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in Washington on the TAPS tariff for interstate rates, and also a long-standing dispute for the calculation of components in what is known as the quality bank. When Flint Hills and the other refineries, for that matter, on the pipeline take oil out of the pipeline and then make products from it and then dispose of oil back into the pipeline, they obviously are changing the quality of the oil for everyone else that's passing through. So as part of it, as I said, it's a fairly long-standing dispute. The refineries have to pay into the quality bank to make those whose oil is being shipped all the way to Valdez, make them whole. There is now, the dispute is related to what various components of that quality bank calculation are. And so Flint Hills and presumably PetroStar as well are probably looking at a change in, we would expect, and the state is in a position to, in this particular case, that if we prevail, if the state prevails, and other shippers prevail, that Flint Hills and PetroStar will have to pay more into the quality bank as a consequence of this new valuation scheme. The tariffs are another issue. Several years ago, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska lowered the intrastate tariff. And today, if you ship oil from the pump station 1 to Valdez for intrastate use, in other words, for the Nikiski refinery, for example, you pay $1.96 for that. The interstate rate has risen over the last few years, and today it's in the neighborhood of $5.20. So it's that difference that that is at issue. And before the FERC, appellants or plaintiffs have asked to have the $5.20 interstate rate decreased. And because of the vagaries of how we calculate the price for Flint Hills' oil, they deduct that $5.20 from their price. And it's subject to a retroactive provision in their contract should the FERC order a new change to the tariffs that have been suspended during this litigation, that the state will then collect on the difference if that $3 or so difference is adjusted.
So a tanker loading fuel in Valdez and winding up offloading it somewhere else is charging $5-something a barrel for that trip?
The pipeline is charging the $5.20, yes, for that. The tanker charges are even more after it leaves Valdez. So what we're, to put it another way, oil is valued at pump station 1 on the North Slope in a net back calculation, where you begin with a market price where the oil is sold on the West Coast. Typically, we talk about the ANS spot price as a measure of that. Deducted from that are the cost of tankers or a location differential, one or the other, and then a deduction for the tariff and adjustments for quality. So the $5.20 that I'm referring to is only the cost of service of getting the oil from the North Slope to Valdez. I hope that helps clear this up.
It does, but I thought you said that it was $5 from Valdez out rather than in.
No, the arithmetic is a series of deductions.
Thank you. Representative Seaton?
So am I to kind of understand in general terms, if the interstate rate is $5, that's deducted from what Flint Hills pays. If FERC says, okay, it's it's only going to have been $3 and there's a $2 difference, then that, then Flint Hills should have only been deducting $3, or the state should have only been deducting $3 from the price, and therefore Flint Hills would owe the $2 difference. Is that the basic premise of what we're talking about?
That is precisely correct, Mr. Representative Seaton.
Okay. Thank you.
Our division is organized like an oil company, basically. We have a part of it that's responsible for resource evaluation and developing concepts about prospects and exploration, and also monitoring the kinds of development proposals that we receive from the oil industry. We have a section that's involved with monitoring the and administrating our leases, conducting lease sales, and taking care that our leases that the legal documentation of our leases are maintained. These are the core of the agreement we have with the industry, and forms the calculation of our royalty, tells us when we can take royalty in kind and when we can keep it in value, imposes obligations on the part of the lessees to develop the resource and to do so environmentally and responsibly. We have a section devoted to permitting. In jest, it's like a landlord who wants to make sure that their tenants aren't stealing the light bulbs, basically. We have a permitting section whose responsibility is to make sure that those environmental and other issues related to the leases are being met. Those conditions are being met.
Representative Edgman?
It'd be really interesting. I guess made it no secret that I've been a proponent of moving the Division of Habitat back to Fish and Game. But in fairness, from your perspective, having the division in your department made the permitting aspect of your duties a lot easier, or somewhat easier, or I mean, you're all housed within the same building up in Anchorage, the Atwood Building?
It has changed, Mr. Chairman and Representative Edgen. It has changed the dynamic quite a bit, in my opinion. There's better access to the Habitat Division. It is interesting, I think, and it would be fair to point out that an aspect of it that was different before is that with the Habitat Division inside of DNR, the roles of the divisions, you know, the pro-development divisions or the like oil and gas, and the Habitat Division, which is responsible for maintaining habitat and such, is our roles are a little bit more balanced in a sense, almost. You don't have the same kind of elevation to commissioners and that kind of tension that had existed beforehand. Good. I think, but perhaps instead of getting too caught up in how we're organized, except to say that the series of slides between, say, page 9 and 13 give us a quick summary of some of the activities that our division has been involved in. I would like to point out in the appendix of my presentation, flipping to, say, page 32 through page 35, is a summary of North Slope and Cook Inlet development activities. At the beginning of the meeting, Chairman Gatto had indicated that we passed out some maps that looked complicated. These tables basically describe some of the features of these maps.
Representative Seaton has a question.
Yes, on number 11, we're talking about PAs, and I never see the definition of what a PA is. Could you give me?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I apologize for that. As is often the case, we get used to using shorthand words and forget that others may not be familiar with them. In forming a unit is basically an aggregation of leases. with the intention of making sure that the correlative rights of those who own those leases are protected when oil developments occur, to make sure that the development occurs economically and with a minimum of environmental impact, so that one set of facilities is built over a field instead of many, and so you don't have wells that are drilled unnecessarily. So the idea is for the efficient and economic production of our oil by aggregating all of the leases over a prospect. Typically speaking, we at the formation of a unit, the size of the tank, so to speak, is not quite known, but as the exploration occurs and we form an opinion about how big that tank is, a participating area is formed. That's what PA means. And that will then allocate the production from that participating area to the various owners, including the state, as the royalty owner. Eventually, the notion would be, as the participating area is our knowledge about it is refined, the unit will shrink to the size of that participating area. Acreage then that is left outside of the unit at that point can be released, and we can try to attract new entrants or new ideas to develop perhaps other resources outside of the participating area.
Follow up.
Yep.
Thank you. So I understand, I think, what the unit is. The unit is the pool area, and the participating areas, like four new participating areas, what's the distinction there?
Again, we start with a fairly large unit. It could have more than one participating area in it, depending on the zones that are producing, that wells are producing from. Notionally, then, the PA is a smaller entity than the unit and is defined by the pool of hydrocarbons that are there. And as I said, you could have one at one depth, another participating area at another depth for a different zone of hydrocarbons. And in defining a participating area, the most important feature there is that it determines what share of production each of the owners will receive from that participating area. And it could very well be, depending on the ownership of the various leases on the surface, that the Company A may get 60% of the production of participating area X, and Company A only gets 20% of participating area Y. And so it's a way of managing the correlative rights, as they're known, of the various participants in the unit. I hope that clarifies the point.
So following up, so a unit then is going to be a surface area designation, and a participating area is a reservoir designation?
I think that would be a fair way of putting it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Chair.
Oh,
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Before I get to my question, sometimes we need to the perspective on what goes on up there as far as the definitions are not just on the vertical, on the horizontal surface, but also down. Depth, the different depth of different fields. The facilities might be right next to each other, but they represent really different entities. But my question goes back to your slide 15, where you talk about the Pipeline Systems Integrity Office. And I'm wondering, reading the transition reports for DNR, Pipeline Integrity Office, the Lease Monitoring and Engineering Integrity Coordinator's Office, is at LEMECO. I was wondering what your role in that was, and if it's situated in your department situated in that, or that situated in yours, or what role have you had with that office? Because the recommendations certainly talk about having a better understanding it between all the parties. So just kind of exploring that and kind of find out the overall pipeline and the systems integrity that's going on, certainly as a result of what happened last year and what the changes have been as far as understanding the gaps and the overlaps and where some of the voids are in that, and understanding what the situation is in the regulatory process up in North Slope.
Long question, but LAMICO, and you mentioned it, and some people probably never heard it before, relating to inspecting the pipeline.
Well, I'm not sure it's the pipeline. I think it's just the North Slope. And I can, LAMICO, and it's in the transition report, is the governor signed an administrative order establishing a lease monitoring, engineering, and integrity coordinator's office within DNR, and that's LAMICO. So my question is, what is your role or participation in that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, let me try to deal with it. On page 20 in my slide pack, there's a set of bullets that describes the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office. So let me try to make some distinctions here. Under the administrative order that you refer to, there was a plan to create a coordinator's office with liaisons from each of the involved departments, DEC, the Joint Pipeline Office, and others, and federal agencies as well, in one place, physically in one place. The governor today is now reviewing that plan, and we have suggested rather the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office as an alternative, as somewhat thinly described here in this slide. Because it is still in review, please, you know, indulge me before I get into too much detail. But I can tell you right now, the point would be is to not establish a separate coordinator's office modeled after the Joint Pipeline Office, but rather to identify liaison people in each of the departments, make the arrangements that it takes so that there's a full and complete communication among those agencies, and then as the first task, examine where there are gaps in the regulatory authorities and make sure those are filled. It is resident in the Division of Oil and Gas because the pipeline facilities that we're looking at are within the units that we manage. And our unit agreements permit our basically give us the authority at DNR to manage and inspect the facilities there so that production occurs safely and continuously. So that I hope that touches on the notion of what we're thinking about.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I hope that at some point in the future we have the opportunity to get into this a little bit deeper, because it might take some oversight from the legislature with this office to make sure that that happens.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I owe you a description of these maps. The first I'll point out is the North Slope map, and at Representative Gatto, Chairman Gatto's insistence and wise counsel, I may add, I'll point out two things that you should note here so that it's not so confusing. Basically, we've described in the big black bold lines the units on the North Slope on state lands. In the call-out boxes are a description of activities that are underway or have occurred in the last several months on the North Slope. So I could draw your attention, for example, to, in the center, Anadarko, Nikaichuk delineation wells spudded, 06 and 07. In fact, there's a well underway as we speak. The second well is being drilled there. Or we could go down to for the Kaparik River unit over on the left-hand side, Nanook production startup. Now there's a case where a satellite production in a new PA, a new participating area within the Colville River unit, has begun producing oil. So this, combined with the descriptions of North Slope activities on page 32, which explains a little bit more detail, are an indication of increased exploration activities on the North Slope this year, and which I would like to demonstrate is pretty enthusiastic news. We have new players involved. Shell Oil has a fairly significant land position on the Outer Continental Shelf. We have Eni, the Italian national oil company, is participating not only in the Outer Continental Shelf on federal lands, but also in the Ugarit unit, in the Nikhachevtuvik unit, and is also working wells down in Rockflower and Majori, a lease operation at Majori. There are companies busy working in NPRA as well, which is not illustrated on this map, in a fairly significant way. Folks at ConocoPhillips continue to work the Colville River unit and are exploring in NPRA along with FEX, another company that's new to Alaska. And similarly, the map for Cook Inlet, again, the dark bold lines represent units in the Cook Inlet. Always remember, if it's green, it's oil. If it's red, it's gas. And I'll point out that last week, the division approved three new units in the Cook Inlet at North Alexander, up near the Matanuska Susitna Borough area, and two offshore units at Corsair in the Kitchen unit north of Nikiski. And those two offshore units, in order to meet the work commitments there, will require offshore drilling. And we can hope that we will soon see a jackup rig in the Cook Inlet drilling for the wells in those two units. Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that I'd like to end my discussion there and take any more questions that anyone may have and not belabor my privilege to be able to speak before you today.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. there were some leases that were purchased several years ago that had some real difficulty getting permitting and took what I think is an extraordinary amount of time to permit. Have those been done? And I'm not familiar with it. We talked about it a little earlier at a briefing at DNR. The kind of the reasoning was we were busy working on the pipeline and yada yada. And so, are all the leases? Maybe reframe the question. Have all the leases that have been awarded been permitted in the Cook Inlet?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, the frank answer to that is probably no, because we've just had a recent sale there. I think you are referring to a lease sale that occurred, I think, almost a couple of years ago.
Right, it's been several years.
And as I understand it, all of those leases have been issued, and we're nearly up to date on the most current lease sales. Our last Cook Inlet lease sale was held just in May, and I would be with 71 tracks sold. I could be positive that those leases haven't yet been issued, but that's not an abnormal length of time for us. There's a lot of survey work that needs to be done and
follow-up
title work.
Excuse me. So do I understand that from the time a lease is purchased, and that someone can actually, for lack of a better term, take possession of it and start drilling, is 2 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, no, I should hope not. It should be quite a bit less than that. What is happening, we were caught, I think it's fair to say, behind the eight ball with staffing problems, which I believe have been largely solved. We had to rely on title work done by Mining, Land, and Water in our department. The division has basically hired a title person to work in that division, taking care of our leases, and that's removed a significant bottleneck. I can't tell you today offhand how long it takes to get a lease, but I will tell you what the reason why it doesn't happen the day after you receive the you win the bid. We offer our leases now in area-wide lease sales. Prior to I think 1999 or 98, we would select an area and do all of the title work before the sale occurred, so that after the lease sale, the administration of the lease was fairly quick. Now we wait until after the sale so we know which tracts need that kind of survey and title work done. And so instead of doing title work on land that's never purchased, we can target our efforts to just the lands that have received bids. And furthermore, we are offering the whole area of the Cook Inlet each year, and that provides industry with a very predictable and manageable access to the oil and gas lands in both the North Slope, in the Cook Inlet, Beaufort Sea, and now in the Bristol Bay region.
Senator Guttenberg.
Thank you. Last year we had the governor's pipeline contract on the table. Did you feel any change of the oil and gas community, the exploration and development group, as a result of that, and since that contract and change of administration has changed? Has there been any change in the attitude about the industry as far as development? Because I know from my perspective, talking with some people, they were kind of on hold to wait and see what would happen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, I can say one thing. I've been talking with some of our explorers over the last several weeks, and I don't know if you can attribute this to the circumstances of the SGDA contract and now the response of industry to the new administration, but it is coincidental that I'm told by exploration companies that they're targeting gas on the North Slope, not just oil. So that in itself to me says something. I think there's an expectation on the part of new players that this pipeline is going to be built by the time they're ready to participate.
And exactly when is that?
Another question.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Yeah, I want to know that too. You know, the maps that you have are basically Cook Inlet and a North Slope, but there are other activities going on around the state, certainly not at this point as a major. Could you expand a little bit on the activities that are happening in the Nanana Basin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, let me take a swack at it. We have a exploration license over the area, and some seismic work has been completed, I think, in conformance to the work commitments that were required there. I'm reaching into memory banks that could be faulty, but I think there was a plans to drill a well there, but those plans are currently on hold. I'm told that the geology in the Nanana Basin is very complicated. It's in terms of its regional geology, it's somewhat like the Cook Inlet, but its local geology makes it a very complex place to look for oil, fractured, small pieces, and maybe some difficulty uncertainty of whether or not the drilling program there would yield an economic source of gas for the local use in, say, Fairbanks, or for delivery to some kind of pipeline. So that's what I can tell you today about that.
Do they require a approval from you to put the drilling on hold? Was that part of the lease, or have they asked for modifications of the agreement out there?
I don't think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, that the well was part of the work commitment for the license.
And on that line, I'm curious as to know what the level of activity is. Do we have just seismic? Do we have some proven reserves? Do we have just the idea? I'm not sure where we are at Nenana.
Representative Gatto, we're at Nenana. Seismic has been done, and we're at a phase, I think, in the exploration where that information is being evaluated, and the question remains as to whether or not an exploration well is, okay, is the logical next step.
So there are no holes in the ground at this point?
I think no holes drilled recently, no, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
When you, Mr. Chair, when you find the rules chair seeking a bridge across the river, the Nenana, you know, there's one going south out of on the Parks Highway,
right,
that was had no road on the other side of it. It was built, it was named after his father.
Mm-hmm.
And they eventually built the parks to hook up there. And you know, John has been scratching his head about some kind of crossing over there for a lot of reasons. When you hear about that or hear the rumors, that's certainly the exploration and is part of that dialogue.
Yeah, thank you. We're, I kind of envisioned, to be honest, my expectations were higher, that I thought we had proceeded further than what we understand now is that without, I thought we had holes in the ground when we were talking in Nenana, and that it seemed like this was a prospect, but like a lot of things, wasn't truly the birthday day yet, and we were celebrating, so. But, you know, I hope it's something that proves out for City of Fairbanks and for the whole state.
And Mr. Chairman, let me offer to send you a more complete summary of the activities at the Nenana Basin.
Thank
so
you.
So that I won't be caught off guard stretching too far
and,
into belief instead of what I know.
If you have an extra copy, Representative Guttenberg, I think, wouldn't mind seeing the same thing.
I'd be delighted. Thank you.
And is there an oil well in Wrangell somewhere? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm kind of getting off subject just a little bit, but on page 5, where it talks about royalties to the permanent fund and to the school fund.
Oh.
And so I know that that there's land across Alaska that is set aside for school funding. And I know a lot of it hasn't even been surveyed and so, you know, all that type of thing yet. Do they try to work, when you guys try to move a little bit on that each year to try to get some of that in so that we can see if there's any revenues in any of those places that we can start using for school funding?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, let me take a stab at answering that. The school fund referred here is half a percent of our royalties goes into a school fund. I don't think it's a very large fund, frankly, and it's not. I think what you're referring to are the land holdings owned by the university, perhaps.
No, there's two different follow-up. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
There's two different groups. There was the university lands, but there's also lands for K-12, and they just kind of float around and they're there. Most of them haven't even been, you know, surveyed and that type of thing. But the state does have a responsibility to try to develop some of those lands so that there is money for schools, and I was just wondering where that was at.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, I'll have to get back.
Okay. Thank you.
And I take it you're only referring to this comment on page 5, and school fund,
yeah,
with the note number 1, which says includes federally shared rentals and royalties, and to be honest, I'm off on this one too. I don't know.
Well, I can explain the footnote, Mr. Chairman. We receive about 27% of the royalties from what is called the 8G lands between 3 miles and 6 miles in the Outer Continental Shelf. So when the Minerals Management Service at the Department of Interior sells lands in the OCS.
What does AG stand for?
AG refers to the section in the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act.
Between 3 and 6 miles, it's called AG.
Yeah, that's the reference that we use because that's
It's revenues from those lands that the federal government is obliged to share with the coastal states. And so we receive about 27% of, for example, the royalty collected by the federal government on their leases in the North Star unit on the North Slope. Mm-hmm. There are also federal lands that are producing in the Cook Inlet, where we receive, I believe, 90% of the royalties under the Statehood Act, the Mineral Leasing Act.
What happens beyond 6 miles?
That belongs, and all of those royalties belong to the federal government.
Thank you.
On that subject, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. So, looking at that, the AG section, as far as it relates to Alaska, what happens in the Gulf Coast? Is the situation different? Is the royalty spread division different down there than it is here? Are we treated better or worse? Or I know this came up after Katrina when they were talking about all the oil rigs that had gone down and the royalties, but I didn't really understand it as it related to how Alaska does business.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, I think the 8G revenues apply to all coastal states equally. That's a 27.5% share of the royalties. There have been many occasions where coastal states, through Congress, have tried to acquire a greater share of the OCS revenues, further, from the total stream of royalties collected by the Minerals Management Service by the federal government. To my knowledge, none of those have ever really gone anywhere, because obviously states like Kansas get a little frustrated when they see their revenue. Their federal revenues clipped by someone in Louisiana or Florida.
I won't tell my wife that, she's from Kansas.
Have a follow-up?
Well, yeah. So the revenue division is by what state is it's offshore from?
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
It doesn't go into a large pool, and then okay.
That would be correct. Yeah.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious, because my understanding was that in the last Congress there was a bill that Alaska was included with for a little while, but the five southern states got 75% of those offshore royalties, and Alaska got cut out of that in the last go-around, so it only applied to Florida and Louisiana and those states. So, in fact, that's why I and I think others wrote letters to opposing that, because we opposing the Bristol Bay leases, because that would have applied to the Bristol Bay leases, and we got cut out of that distribution in the last Congress. So if I'm incorrect in that, maybe you can give us some information on it or get back to us.
Mr. Chairman, I promise I will get back to you on that issue, see how it turned out. Of course, you understand there are no current leases in the Bristol Bay on the OCS.
Mr. Representative Edgman?
That might be the natural segue then to my question. I represent the one legislative district where there are no controversial resource projects at all. or offshore. And so that's why I'm happy to ask this question. But just following forth on Representative Seaton's mention of the first debate, does the division play any role in the OCS process? I'm sure you probably do from a information standpoint, but any action or policy making a role at all?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edmund, the role that I see for the division is to provide, as OCS development, the environmental process, the leasing process is conducted by the MMS. There are several opportunities where the state can respond, provide comment, And it'll be our division that will coordinate those comments on behalf of the governor, or for the governor's signature, I probably should say more correctly.
Sure. Okay. Well, Representative Guttenberg?
Just kind of moving into the outfield, but Division of Geological Survey does its magnetic mapping of interior, a lot of places for extraction, for looking for gold and others. But is that mapping process of any use for oil and gas, or do they simply not go deep enough, possibly just looking for closest surface formations?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I think I'd prefer Bob Swenson answer that question. It would be my opinion, yes, we do magnetic surveys. They contribute to the some of the initial work in an exploration play. It provides data that is suitable for at that stage in looking for oil and gas. DGGS also does field work, field studies, and frequently our staff participates with theirs as in specifically for oil and gas work. And I like to think of Bob Swenson and I have basically agreed that at some level the division of labor on that account is he's out there in the deep exploration phase, in the initial exploration phase for oil and gas, and then the division of oil and gas steps in when it's time to start working up prospects and developing the resource. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is Marie, were you also going to join a presentation, or are you done? Okay. We had Kurt Gibson. Kurt, are you there?
Yeah, this is Kurt Gibson.
You're there for answers, but not for commentary?
Through the chair, Representative, I don't have any presentation materials to roll out today. I just wanted to make myself an available resource in the event there were questions that you had to direct to me.
Okay. Are there Representative Seaton has a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm not sure whether it's who it's to, but on page 15, these issues, we kind of skipped over some of the issues like Point Thompson unit, and the audit reopeners.
Yeah, sure. Whether we could rejoin us here. Page 15. Issues and Point Thompson is number 2.
Right, Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, I can tell you that the following the decision by Commissioner Menge in November 27th, the lessees in the Point Thompson unit asked for reconsideration, and that was followed by in December 27th by a follow-up decision on the part of Commissioner Rutherford, which basically affirmed the first decision almost simultaneously to the request for reconsideration. The lessees have sued the state, appealed to the Superior Court on the issue of the termination of the unit. And at the moment, we are moving ahead in that lawsuit. I think there's a motion to consolidate the appeals into a single case, and that's where we stand at the moment.
Do you know if the company's appeal, I mean, in reading the state constitution, did they feel like the constitution was unconstitutional, or did they feel like the state had not honored the constitution?
Well, given the nature of the issue, perhaps that would be a better question to ask
the Attorney General
or the companies themselves.
I mean, most of us have read the Constitution, and surprisingly, it looked like they didn't base their opinion on nothing. There was information there, and just trying to make it get us all up to speed about the current level of understanding of the lawsuit itself. But we're always interested in lawsuits. We follow them diligently.
I think I'd rather punt on the question, Mr. Chairman, if you
don't
enough. Mind.
Sure. Representative Seaton, did you have another issue?
On these issues, maybe we could just go through them. Sure. I think we just kind of skipped those pages.
I'm sorry, sir. You see North Slope Natural Gas Pipeline. I've been talking to folks. I think you all know that the gas line team, led by Commissioner Rutherford, are proceeding. There's been discussions with applicants and experts about how the formation of the Alaska Gas Inducement Act should be developed. I can talk about perhaps how it differs to a certain extent from what I see the SGDA process was. And I think it would be fair to say that the Stranded Gas Development Act. And I think I don't think I'm going too far out on a limb to say that part of this, part of the discussion of the AGIA that will be held by this body and the Senate will be a discussion of what the state wants and wants out of a pipeline. And so that differs from the process before, where the act, basically Stranded Gas Development Act, described a process but without content, in a sense, about getting to the point of what you want, mm-hmm. until finally at the end a contract was offered up to the legislature without that discussion having occurred first.
Well, we're expecting in somewhat longer than 2 weeks from now something from the governor. I know there was some speculation and print that said in 2 weeks we'll get the governor's bill. And I have not seen the governor say that or any member from the governor's office say that. So I'm willing to just sit back until we do get something from the governor on that issue. Meanwhile, you covered Point Thompson, the Integrity Office. How about initiatives in Cook Inlet?
As I mentioned, the new unit initiatives refers to particularly the three units that we approved last week. You could turn back to the activity map to see what other things are going on in the Cook Inlet in terms of new exploration and development. I think at some point there's going to be a discussion about the supply and demand of gas in the Cook Inlet. Obviously, that's going to be an extremely important issue, and it is headlighted, so to speak, or highlighted by the fact that ConocoPhillips and Marathon have announced that they would like to extend the export license to continue shipping LNG to Japan through 2011. And the division has been tasked with examining that application and the materials that the companies will provide to the Department of Energy and to come up with recommendations for the administration on how to respond to the application.
In the new units, I mean, typically they were looking, historically they were looking for oil and found gas. Are these units looking for gas or looking for oil and gas, oil or gas, or do we even care?
Mr. Chairman, there's been a lot more exploration activity in the Cook Inlet in recent years with gas as a target. Clearly that's been the case. And I think that is a trend I can certainly hope will continue. But there have been some 30 exploration wells in the Cook Inlet drilled over the last 50 years or so. But in the, 300 and some wells have been drilled over the last 50 years. But in the last six, 7 years, 30 wells have been drilled, many of which are targeting gas. A lot more exploration activity that is going on now as the market appears to be opening up, changing, and new players are interested in participating.
30 wells, a lot of wells. Do we know what the end result was? Are these dry holes, or are these semi-productive and we don't know yet, or actually do we have some new reserves that are kept secret, or?
No, we have new reserves as a result of some of that exploration. Many of the wells were drilled into existing known prospects, and development on those is still waiting. There have been a few dry holes.
Okay. Representative Seaton?
Thank you. I understood that the gas price has been increasing significantly, and that has been, or at least with the RCA, that was reported as the reason to approve those higher gas prices is so it would stimulate development and exploration for more gas, because, you know, if you're at a very cheap price, nobody is going to explore for gas because, you know, your market is very cheap. But then I understood that the RCA at a meeting not too long ago, did they discount that and looked at the exploration activity that had taken place since and decide that increase in price had not been the determining reason for exploration, and can you fill us in on that determination at all and how that will be probably affecting gas price and also gas exploration?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, I believe what the RCA had, it took exception to the price mechanism that was offered by the by NSTAR and Marathon in the APL 5 contract. Objected to the mechanism used, the price indices used, because it was felt that it captured market values that might not be appropriate for the Cook Inlet. The contract included a Louisiana Henry Hub price indices. It's published price for gas delivered to a fairly a large complex of and gathering of pipelines in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's subject to the market conditions that prevail there. It's widely used in the lower 48 as an indicator of gas price, and when you watch CNBC, it's that price that's scrolling across the bottom of the page, the bottom of the screen. The notion was, I believe, the RCA felt that choosing a market indicator like that somehow didn't have anything to do with the real cost of providing gas here in the Cook Inlet. Would hurricanes that might interrupt the supply of gas and jack up the price of the hub, Henry Hub price, shouldn't apply to what's going on in the Cook Inlet. On the other hand, I'm not so sure that there was the RCA categorically said that it was because that price was too high, but rather that there would be a better indicator of market price, say closer to the wellhead in the lower 48, which would still be higher than what we see in some of the historical contracts in the Cook Inlet. In my opinion, frankly, I think that when the Unocal NSTAR contract was signed some years ago and approved by the RCA, using a similar lower 48 Henry Hub price mechanism, it did alter the picture of and expectations for higher prices in the Cook Inlet, and that did have an effect of generating a good deal more exploration activity here. I think that's an undeniable correlation, in my opinion.
Representative Seaton.
Well, to follow up, I mean, you know, all I know is what I read in the papers. And what I was reading in the papers was they were denying that because they had looked at it and had initially approved the Henry Hub and the higher price contract on the presumption that was purported that that would initiate exploration. And what I read was they looked at the data and said the companies kept the profits but it didn't expand that exploration, and so that they were denying that same kind of thing. So what are we left with? Are we left with a cheap price in Cook Inlet that is not going to expand the exploration fields? Are we I mean, I don't know. I'm really asking for information as to what our prognosis here is for price and for exploration and the economics of exploring in the Cook Inlet Basin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, I believe that we're going to see NSTAR and Marathon, perhaps Marathon, but NSTAR has a wedge, a gap in its supply requirements that will appear, according to them, in 2009. And they will have to go back into the marketplace and find sellers that can fill that gap. And I suspect that it will be at prices that are higher than we've seen historically. I can go that far. And I think it's just inevitable. And probably because it does have an effect of encouraging more exploration, it at the end of the day, I think is the right thing to have happen. The one of our economists, Will Nebesky, sitting in at the other end of the phone, he's described the market as a tightened balance. That what happens is that there's only so much gas that can be consumed in the inlet. Because we're isolated from any other destination, with the exception of the LNG. And as a result, once that demand has been satisfied, it's going to be pretty hard to put any more gas in. And frankly, to put any more gas in at any price. But there are resources out there, maybe fairly significant ones, where a market needs to be cracked open so that we can see an increase in reserves instead of what looks like a pretty precipitous drop in reserves.
Yeah, I think it's worth making one comment here about our LNG exports. Many people feel we ought to quit exporting LNG and save it for South Central. But something was explained to me that I think is worth explaining to the committee. That is, the demand for gas in Cook Inlet is 3 times higher in the winter than the summer. And the companies essentially have the capacity to supply summer supplies. They need to be able to up it to 3 times that value. And what happens is the LNG exports are reduced in the winter so that we can make up for the multiplier during the winter by reducing the exports and having them available for South Central. And the point, the end result, is that having LNG exports is good for South Central and Cook Inlet because it allows us to essentially have gas for a decent price because we don't need the structure to reserve 3 times the amount of gas, but only the summer demand. And the rest of it is met by the supply that LNG is reduced by. In the end, though, we say, well, we could run out of gas doing that. But you're telling us probably not, in that once the market demands it, the gas is there and it can be developed.
Mr. Chairman, there is a chicken and the egg problem here, of course. Our estimates show that there's another 8 years of reserves in the ground that we know about. That's producing, developed, and known reserves in the fields that are already have been developed. There's another maybe 1.6 trillion cubic feet of gas, double that number, the what we know is in the ground, that could be explored for. And so it would add another 8 years beyond that. And that yes, there is more gas there. It's going to be harder to find. It's going to be more expensive to develop. And at issue then is, if you were to find a field with 10 BCF in it, which would supply a small fraction of our marketplace, it's possible that that producer could find a place in the market, squeeze into the marketplace. If the same producer were to find 100 BCF or 200 BCF of gas, a much larger field, that producer might be standing in line waiting to develop its resource. And so where I say that the market needs to have, that the market needs to accommodate for that kind of a discovery somehow. And believe me, that's an issue that we are going to be wrestling with in the next couple of months. With respect to the export license extension.
And just one more piece. I guess Nikiski is the smallest LNG plant in the nation, and whatever they're exporting, they're really, am I correct?
Nikiski is the only export LNG.
So it's also the largest.
The largest.
That makes it the largest as well.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as relative to the other LNG export plants, which in other countries is pretty substantial.
I believe that's correct. And your portrayal of the seasonal swings in the marketplace is on balance a correct description what is at issue for particularly NSTAR and to a lesser extent the other electrical utilities, in that what NSTAR requires in a contract is that kind of deliverability, and it can be provided for by developing the field with a lot of compression, with a lot of wells. It can be provided for by constructing and providing storage, usually spent gas fields where gas is injected in the summertime and drawn out during the winter, or as you've already mentioned, by backing out supplies that go to the LNG plant. And historically, that was a role, in fact, that Agrium played, too, at the fertilizer plant, where you could back out supplies going to that industrial user to supply on those very, very cold peak days in the region.
Representative Wilson had one.
Yes. And I'm going back to another page that we didn't get to, page 31.
I'm going to bring fewer pages next time.
Well, you know, this would be a good review for some of us that were here last year, but also for the newer ones. And I realize that some of them are for the Department of Revenue, maybe, but mm-hmm. If you could kind of go over that.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Wilson. Sure. This is an inventory of the kinds of incentives that can be offered either automatically or at the request and application of a lessee, a producer, and they figure into the economics of an exploration prospect differently because of that. In some cases you could probably count on it, in other cases you know you have to ask for permission. And that would be, say, for example, the case for royalty reduction, the first in the list. AS 3805-180J is a statute that applies to our offering of royalty relief. It can only be provided for at the end of field life or to restart a well that's been shut in which case we can offer a royalty rate as low as 3%, or in the case of a new field, which was a change in this statute, probably the only change in the statute for many, many years, was to add in the mid-90s a feature that said if you could establish that the economics of developing a fairly well delineated prospect could be enhanced by lowering the royalty rate, and the Commissioner of Natural Resources was persuaded, then a royalty relief to 5% could be offered. That has been applied once at the Ugaruk unit, in which where they will receive a 5% royalty until such time as a trigger designating payout in the unit occurs sometime in the future. Exploration incentive credits, listed as a second bullet there, are offered with the lease, so that it would be drafted into the lease to say, in the first case, 180i, that we will pay for, say, half of the drilling cost or seismic cost as a condition of the lease. Perhaps that would be offered together with a very specific work commitment, perhaps. We have used incentive credits like this recently in the Cook Inlet. The AS4109010 refers to a similar program that would be offered on in conjunction with our exploration licenses, like the Nanana, for example, although I don't know that one was offered there or taken. And that also applies, I might add, to non-state land as well as our own land. Discovery royalties. Most recently, the Cook Inlet Sedimentary Basin 5% royalties have been offered, and then previous to that, just a flat 5% rate was settled on for the five fields listed here, which, for example, Redoubt Shoals is an example of production that has occurred, I think, as a consequence of the lower royalty. It also has, however, a sunset provision, and turns off if you find a lot of oil or a lot of gas. The royalty rate would return to its lease rate at that point. But that was a rate that was set out by the legislature. Exploration incentive credits and the PPT combine now. Most of the exploration incentive credits under 4355025 apply to the North Slope, where depending on how far away you are from local infrastructure and another well, you can get up to 40% of your well cost paid for by tax credits. And there are similar, I think there's a similar provision for wells drilled outside of the North Slope. And lastly, the PPT is, I think most of you are maybe more familiar with than I am, but tax credits in the form of in all of its forms are available to the North Slope producers. And at certain, I am told that at certain price levels, at very high price levels, when the PPT taxes is at its maximum, the state may be offering up to 60-70% of the cost of drilling an exploration well under the PPT. And I think it remains to see how exploration activities will respond to that. It's still pretty soon for that to play out.
Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. I was going to go back to page 16, but page 31 is a good segue into that. There was a recent article in the New York Times that dealt with, I think, mostly Gulf Coast oil and gas issues. And basically what it said was, in the long term, oil and gas tax and other incentives for production didn't produce any more oil and gas than was going to be produced otherwise. And simply because the oil industry or the gas industry came to the state or the feds looking for reductions for things that they were going to do anyway, but just enhancements for their corporate bottom line. But that takes me to page 16, where it's long-term issues. And I think you know, you're talking about facilities access and North Slope production decline, dealing with that. Are you doing anything to expand the number of explorers and producers on the North Slope? And that certainly has to do with facilities access. From my perspective, that would open up more exploration and create more jobs, which are one of the key things in the state, putting more people to work. So maybe just deal with that and have a discussion on the two issues on the long term, page 16.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, clearly facility access is extremely important. And it goes not just, as I think many people think about, facilities as the big machinery, the machines you see in large buildings all over the North Slope, but it also applies to the pipelines as well. So our discussion of interstate and intrastate tariffs earlier, low tariffs mean a lot to someone who is looking to find oil and produce it, and who does it because it just increases the amount they're going to get for their net back value of the oil that they produce. So the state's position and the role in that dispute, I think, is important. We offer land every year on the North Slope on a predictable and area-wide basis, so people know that they'll have access to the resource that's available at unleased lands in a predictable way. More specifically, the issue of facility access is, I'd have to say, we have examined what the capacity and the capability of the facilities are on the North Slope as part of a study that was done a few years ago, and we're trying to play a role at the moment of assuring that the existing players, the incumbents, are playing fairly with the newcomers. I put it at the stage of observation and moral suasion where we can, and however, we are examining whether or not there aren't, if we don't have tools in our toolbox to be a little bit more proactive about that. That's the state of play at the moment. I might also add that virtually all of the facilities on the North Slope are running at or near capacity. They're constrained either by water, gas handling, or for that matter, oil in some of the newer oil fields. So that putting someone else's oil into your facility will come to you at a cost of backing out some of the oil that you are now producing. The way I like to think about this, however, is that chances are the oil that someone wants to, or the fluids that someone wants to bring to your facility has much higher oil content than the facility is currently receiving from your own oil field. And so that therein is an opportunity to run these facilities more efficiently and perhaps a commercial outcome can be derived from that, because both parties will benefit by more efficient use of the equipment that's there. So I would prefer to see a commercial solution to this problem, and I'd like to suggest that if that doesn't work, then the state needs to become more proactive.
And just to follow up on that.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. One of the things we learned from last year's exercise was the relationship with independents and others besides the facility owners is a big part of this process and bringing people in to be economically viable. And not everything on the North Slope is regulated, either by FERC or RCA. And some of those gaps become restrictions of trade, and because all of a sudden, you know, there's a regulated entity here, the oil and the separation are regulated, and X, Y, and Z is separated, and all of a sudden there's a gap in there it's not regulated, and the charges can be whatever they need them to be to keep somebody out. and the independents know that and they look at that. So is there any effort, and also it was part of the dialogue on the corrosion problems on the Mill Slope. Are you looking at that with RCA, or is RCA looking at that to close all those gaps to make sure there aren't any gaps? And this is part of my question about an overview of the departments, whether it's DEC or FERC, I mean DEC or DNR and VRCA, to make sure that there aren't any gaps in this process of overseeing the pipeline. So is that part of that dialogue?
Well, you've touched on two points, Representative Burke, through the chair. In terms of systems integrity, that's part of the process that we're going to undertake first. So where are the regulatory and gaps in the authority, the gaps in authority to implement a monitoring program? And with respect to the question of facility access, it is an area that needs to be explored. I'm not sure if the right answer, and frankly, I'd be a bit concerned about, for example, pipeline access is regulated by RCA and the FERC, and the boundary of that is typically the boundary of the unit. The Division of Oil and Gas, and through its unit agreements, has some authority that perhaps can be exercised for facility access upstream of the boundary of the unit. We're looking into that. I think that's and what needs to be done and what we can exercise in that area.
Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Banks, I guess one of the things that we're looking at in these issues and long-term issues are all some of what we looked at last year. But I noticed your long-term issues are, you know, fostering programs to slow oil production decline and facility access, and that's what we were worried about in the gas line is the same thing. And one of the biggest problems we've had is trying to provide capacity for the minor players and everything else. And I know the chairman is looking at scheduling a meeting in the next couple of weeks on gas to liquids and that technology of converting gas to oil, injecting into the TAPS pipeline to foster that decline. And some of the information that we've got is that could be 500,000 barrels a day additional liquid into the pipeline, extending its life to 2035 without further discoveries of oil, and also that would give us greater options to consider under a gas pipeline, because we wouldn't have to have the single pipeline to handle all the facilities access and that capacity. And I don't know that you're prepared to discuss that now, but I would sure hope that you and the state comes back to the hearing, the table, when we're talking about those things, because it appears that it has some potential for solving and meshing some of these access problems, pipeline capacity, what we need in the design is also your long-term issue of fostering program to slow North Slope oil production decline. So I sure hope you'll be back and be able to discuss some of those issues with us at that hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Seaton. I plan.
And I think Representative Seaton's concern, as well as my concern, is if we ever reach the point of DRNR on the TAPS line, which is demobilization, removal, and remediation, that is, pick up the pipe and put it somewhere else. We're never going to get it replaced. And once that pipeline is gone, it's gone literally forever. And what gas liquids does is it says, got the whole resource. Pipeline is in place. All we've got to do is the new find is the gas that goes in the pipeline, but it can't go in as gas. So we convert it to a liquid, put it in the pipeline. It's probably the final straw if we can't get a gas line. But I think he and I have the same concern that there are always possibilities of things going really bad for us, in that the price of steel is so much we can't build a pipeline, cooperation is not there. The demand drops off. You can't get cooperation in Canada. You can't find ships. All those possibilities, and we're trying to make sure that in the end, something can happen. Otherwise, the end result is shut the lights, lock the door, sell your house, and move to America, because we can't support our population without 85% of our revenue. We can't do it in any other way. And so he and I both want to make sure that we at least have backup plans for, and I think it helps when you have a backup plan to encourage the first choices too. Mm-hmm. And so he refers to those hearings that we're planning in the future, not because we think that's the way it'll go, because we want to make sure we at least have the possibility of it going that way. Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you. And just a point on the DRR, that's more than just removing the pipe. It's removing the roads, pump station,
mediation,
all the facilities, basically restoring it to pristine. And personally, I don't think we'll ever get there. I don't think the industry will get there. But that goes back to the point I want to make, and the question I'd like to make is, theoretically, or reality is, there's supposed to be money put aside for DRR. And where is it? I think, from what my understanding is, it's not in the state account. It's somewhere hidden in corporate books or corporate accounts or corporate reserves somewhere. And a lot of people are concerned that point, if it ever comes, when it comes to DRR and start paying for those things, the company that's holding all of the ownership and control will simply disappear. There'll be somebody there that's in receivership. So is there a... have you looked at that? Do you know where those reserve accounts are?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, they're on the balance sheet of the owners of that pipeline.
Thank you. And I think what he's saying, we collected a nickel a barrel. It's a lot of nickels. And there is all the money that's necessary, really, to pick up the pipe, pick up the roads, and put the tundra back. And essentially, we were never there. Type of thing. There's enough money to do that, providing when it's time to do it, we found the money. If we don't, I have no idea what will happen, but that's a very good point. You wish the money were in a separate account called DRR account.
And who's making just the interest alone on it?
Yeah. I don't know how much it is even. You said it's hidden it's in the books. Is it $5 million or? Who knows what it would take to do that?
I think there may be there has been. I think that is a knowable answer, frankly, but I don't have it in my head.
Who's the best person to ask? Say, where is it, how much is it, and how do we get it?
I think I can get you that answer. I mean, we've been evaluating. We have folks that have been working the TAPS pipeline tariff methodology for years.
We don't know if it's in one book or in spread out over several companies. It kind of reminds me a little bit about Social Security. Where is the money? Oh, well, don't worry. When your time to cash in on it, it'll be there, we hope. Okay, further questions? Without any more questions, Mr. Banks and Ms. Crosby, I appreciate your attendance. With that, the meeting is adjourned, and don't forget to turn your cell phones back on. Thank you.